Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Wall Street Trading and Speculators Tax Act, introduced today by Senator Tom Harkin, that would generate $352 billion in revenues over 9 years. Mika Hauptmann, the Financial Policy Counsel at Public Citizen, joins us to discuss how a tax of 3 cents on every $100 of speculative trading via high-speed computers could bring human investors back, stabilize markets, and reduce predatory trading. Then Lawrence Wright joins us in the studio. He is a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of a new book just out, Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. We will discuss this new and incredibly wealthy church that the IRS has designated as a tax-exempt religion to try to determine its secret belief systems and what it contributes to mankind as a religion. We will investigate the brutal and sadistic tactics it employs against its own followers and former members, and while many of its members who are trapped in secret locations work around the clock for slave wages, the church's leader lives a lavish lifestyle of a billionaire, cultivating Scientology celebrity frontmen Tom Cruise and John Travolta. Joining us now to discuss the Wall Street Trading and Speculator Tax Act introduced today is Mike Hauptmann, who is a financial policy counsel at Public Citizen, a national nonprofit consumer advocacy organization. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Hauptmann.
Thanks for having me.
And there seems to be quite a bit of activity today in the Senate. There was, of course, the introduction of the Wall Street Trading and Speculative Tax Act by U.S. Senator Tom Harkin and co-sponsored by U.S. Representative Peter DeFazio, which obviously is one of the reasons that I'm calling you. But also, apparently, there's quite an impressive speech made by conservative Republican Senator Vitter in support of doing something about the too big to fail banks. So a lot to talk about. Let's start with Tom Harkin's bill. What do you think the chances are now that we're about to federal government, or at least the Republicans in the House and the Senate, are about to shoot the American economy in the foot? Over $85 billion about to be cut out. Why not entertain the idea of raising some funds in an extremely painless way?
That's exactly right. So in less than 4 hours, I'm on the East Coast, so it's just past 8 o'clock. In less than 4 hours, the so-called sequestration cuts are going to come down, and it's going to be more than $1 trillion over 10 years of cuts. And those cuts are going to be particularly devastating, affecting vital services, including education, food safety, disaster relief, and law enforcement. And one simple solution is to raise revenue instead to fill that gap. So Senator Tom Harkin and Representative Peter DeFazio have introduced today the Wall Street Trading and Speculators Tax Act, which would raise substantial revenue and also help protect the economy against market instability. So the bill has been scored as raising more than $352 billion over 9 years, which is about a third of the way to fill the sequestration gap.
So this is like a companion bill, if you will, to existing bills existing laws, I should say, in at least 29 countries that have financial tax transaction bills. The United Kingdom has a transfer tax on stocks, as does Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, South Korea, Australia, and Switzerland. And most recently, 11 countries in Europe, led by Germany, France, Spain, Italy, all agreed to implement a financial speculation tax, which will take effect by the end of the year. Well, when I last checked, Germany was still the number one economy in the world, or the most vigorous and successful economy in the world. It hasn't hurt them. Australia's doing well. What are the arguments against this that you're hearing?
Well, that's exactly right. One of the biggest industry arguments against the financial speculation tax is that increasing transaction costs would cause people to trade overseas. But that argument doesn't really hold water because as you said, currently about 29 countries already tax financial transactions. So there aren't too many places to go. And all of the big market centers have some form of financial transaction tax. Hong Kong, just to give you one example, a vibrant market, has a financial transaction tax that's 0.3% on stock transactions. So it's 10 times the rate of the Harkin DeFazio bill. So traders are not going to go from the U.S. and move to the Hong Kong and then have to pay 10 times the size of that tax. And just to put Hong Kong's economy in perspective, the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative think tank in Washington, has an annual Freedom Index. It conducts a survey of all the countries in the world and ranks them based on a variety of factors, including financial freedom. And Hong Kong, with its 0.3% tax, ranks number one. So you can have a vibrant market with a financial transaction tax. And London, the same thing. London has a 0.5% transaction tax on stocks, and it's had this tax for over 200 years, and the London Stock Exchange is doing fine.
Well, it's one of the things that it's going to address, this tax, is these automatic computer trades, which in many ways is should be illegal because it's sort of front loading. The big brokerage houses have moved their computers right next to the stock exchange to get that multi-millisecond advantage or fraction advantage in trading, and then and everything's done up by computer, and they just churn over transactions almost for the sake of doing it. There's no thoughts involved. There's no human input. It's just a computer algorithm that finds a way to buy this extraordinary speed it operates at, to buy and sell stocks before anybody knows what's happening. That doesn't strike me as any kind of form of capitalism that you could defend in any realistic way.
That's right. And high-speed trading is volatile, and all it is market speculation that does not lead to growth and productive allocation of capital. And high-frequency trading is a relatively new phenomenon because of ultra-fast computers, high-speed connections, and what it is they're trading at lightning-fast speeds in the milliseconds. So they're executing thousands of trades per second, and often they're engaging in some predatory behavior to jump ahead of traditional investors. So we like to say that it's like high-tech front-running, which is illegal, but somehow they manage to do it. And you know, it's a relatively new phenomenon, but in its pretty early stages, it's already showing how damaging it can be for investors and for the market as a whole. So people, I'm sure, remember on May 6, 2010, there was the so-called flash crash, which in which the Dow dropped almost 1,000 points, and about $1 trillion of wealth was momentarily vanished. So it was really harmful to the market. Luckily, the market recovered, but there are many flash crashes every day. And we saw another instance over the summer with Knight Capital, a computer brokerage firm, and it suffered an algorithmic glitch in which roughly 150 stocks suffered massive fluctuations. So the idea behind the tax is that because high-frequency traders make profits on such tiniest of margins, a tax would decrease their profitability and discourage their activities. And then their activities would be shifted to more productive allocations of capital. And that's really what markets are supposed to do. Markets are supposed to function as intermediaries, connecting investors who provide capital with producers who put that capital to work. And that spurs innovation and job creation. And instead, what we have is constant trading and churning of portfolios, which is just speculation and hurts the economy.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Hauptmann, who's the Financial Policy Counsel at Public Citizen, a national nonprofit consumer advocacy organization. My understanding is that the bill also protects middle-class investors by providing tax credits for contributions to tax-preferred retirement, education, and health savings accounts, including 401ks, 403bs, IRAs, and 529s, etc. So explain that, if you will.
Right. So the goal is to protect middle-class investors in this bill and to foster a productive allocation of capital. And so we don't want investment to be directed on Wall Street at you know, high churning rates, and we want it to be, you know, serving the real economy. And people have some money in their 401ks or 403bs and IRAs, and we want to make sure that they are not being hindered by this tax, and they won't be. They're going to be given preferred status.
So what's the sense then you get, Micah Hoffman, of how the bill's been received? Obviously, its timing is very poignant here, given that what's about to happen to the economy with this latest of the self-inflicted wounds and posed by this series of Republican brinksmanship actions. So anybody sort of seeing this as a lifeline?
Yeah, definitely. The bill was introduced today, and we already have more than 20 co-sponsors of the bill. And there is rapid interest in trying to figure out how we can increase revenue without imposing crippling austerity measures on the nation. And also there's an opportunity within the Obama administration. Timothy Geithner has recently left, and he was a staunch opponent of the tax. But the new Treasury Secretary, Jacob Lew, has expressed interest, and he said he's open to it. He's open to being convinced. So we definitely have an opportunity, and we need to make sure that people are informed on what this bill does and does not do, and we will be in pretty good shape.
So, Micah Hoffman, tell us about what else went on in the Senate today. This speech by Senator Vitter of Louisiana, where he came out against the two big to fail banks, along with his political opposite, if you will, Sherrod Brown.
Right. And the two senators have formed a unique relationship, and Senator Vitter is a conservative Republican, and Senator Brown is a pretty liberal Democrat. But the two have come to the understanding that too big to fail banks are a problem, and it hasn't really been dealt with. Dodd-Frank tried to deal with the issue of too big to fail, and so far we've seen regulators a little bit soft on that issue. And what we see is too big to fail banks are taking advantage of subsidies in the market. So they have lower costs of funding than, let's say, community banks, and they gain advantages. And there was a study recently that said that they gain roughly $83 billion a year in advantages relative to smaller banks. And the problem of too big to fail banks is if they engage in risky activities, the government is going to bail them out because they can't afford for the bank to fall to fail by its own. And so we need to make sure that banks are smaller, simpler, and safer. And Senator Brown and Vitter have teamed up and recognized that it's a problem, and have said this is not an issue that is Republican or Democrat, conservative or liberal. This is an American issue, and it has antitrust concerns. You know, in the early 1900s, the government broke up the big monopolies, and banks have merged to the point that they are too big to regulate, too big to manage, and, of course, too big to fail. So what they want to do is make them smaller and impose some market-based restrictions on them so that they can fail and their failure won't jeopardize the economy.
Well, once again, you would think that the fact that that Bloomberg study that you just referenced, Micah Halpin, which effectively means that the two big to fail banks have effectively subsidized to the tune of $83 billion a year, that would get people's attention, because $83 billion a year is close to the $85 billion that's about to be taken out per year as a result of the sequester. So there's a certain irony there, isn't there?
Yeah, and the big banks are being treated differently than any other individual or corporation would, and they shouldn't be. They should be on the same level.
So, again, what was the atmospherics there like in the Senate?
Well, people are encouraged that there's finally movement to end the too-big-to-fail problem, and there's a consensus building. And so you have George Will on the right, and you have Occupy Wall Street on the left, who all admit the same problem, and now we're going to find a solution. So I commend Senators Vitter and Brown on forging forward.
So in terms of the other bill introduced today by Tom Harkin, what's the next step? I mean, what do our listeners do, for example, who I think a lot of whom will think this is a very good idea and long overdue?
Well, they should call their members of Congress, and they should tell them to co-sponsor the bill, that they should support the bill and pass the bill right away and make sure that all these cuts that are slated to take effect starting tomorrow don't. And they should also tell everybody they know that they should do the same thing.
And this could be implemented right away. In other words, the Treasury could start getting money instead of having programs cut.
Correct.
So, well, I thank you for joining us here today, Micah Halpin.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Again, I've been speaking with Micah Halpin, who's the Financial Policy Council at Public Citizen, a national nonprofit consumer advocacy organization. We're going to take a brief station break, and we will return with Lawrence Wright, who is here in the studio with me, and discuss his new book, Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief.
By which we measure our pain, yeah. I don't believe.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Lawrence Wright, a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of God's Favorite in the New World, Saints and Sinners, Remembering Satan and The Looming Tower, which was the recipient of the Pulitzer Prize, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and the New York Public Library's Helen Bernstein Book Award for Excellence in Journalism. He's also a screenwriter and a playwright, and his latest book just out is Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Wright.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to talk again.
And I take it that in many ways this book sprung out of a profile you did in The New Yorker on the Hollywood screenwriter and director Paul Haggis. That was the last time we talked, and that experience put you into a kind of buzzsaw of litigation or threats of litigation from the Church of Scientology. So explain to me how you stepped into that, given what would have been a kind of warning to most journalists, like, you know, back off, because you're just going to spend all your time dealing with lawyers and not being a journalist.
Well, certainly we took into account the church's reputation for being vindictive and litigious. You know, there was a famous suit in 1991 when Time magazine published an expose of the church, and the church sued and lost at every step along the way up to the Supreme Court. It took a decade, and it cost Time magazine more money to defend itself in a victorious suit than it spent on any other suit in its history. So that was a consideration. But it was such a great story. Despite the kind of picket fence of threats of litigation behind that fence, there was a very important, tremendously intriguing human drama, and we wanted to get to it despite the threats. And so far, they've only been threats. The church hasn't sued the media recently. There have been a number of books out about Scientology. I'm not saying they won't. But, I was very careful. I did what I could to get the church's perspective on all the controversial points. And however reluctant they were, they did comply and on a lot of that. So I'm serene. I feel like I did the best job I can, but I often felt like, you know, that movie The Hurt Locker, where, you know, there's a guy whose job is to take bombs apart before they blow up. I felt a little like that. I just want to make sure that I didn't get the wires crossed.
Well, but in a way, the fact that they're so proactive and so litigious, that has put you in a situation where you have done such zealous fact-checking, has just added more and more credibility to your book. And the whole purpose of this Scientology tactic is to blame the messengers, to slime the messenger. That has been their tactic all along, has it not? In fact, L. Ron Hubbard himself said that the purpose of a lawsuit is to harass and discourage rather than to win.
Yeah. Well, that tactic has earned them a reputation. It's probably the worst reputation of any organized church in the country. I think that they've tried to distance themselves somewhat from that, but they're still very aggressive and hostile towards their former members and towards critics. And of course, you know, they've been after me in various ways, but they're not serious ways. I haven't suffered the way that some of the writers in the earlier part, in the 70s and 80s and 90s, writers who said that, you know, the church had framed them for crimes that they didn't commit, even for murders they didn't commit. Writers who had private investigators following them. There's a whole litany of abuses directed at people who wanted to look at what was going on inside the Church of Scientology.
Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Wright, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of the new book, Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Now, normally one associates religions with the betterment of mankind, and quite often religions, to varying degrees, are dedicated to, particularly in terms of the Christian religion, to following the teachings of Jesus and, by extension, taking care of the poor, which is certainly a part of a lot of the Catholic lay work that goes on, not necessarily what goes on at the Vatican. And in spite of the televangelists obviously shaking down poor people for money, there's still a lot of Protestant churches in this country that do an awful lot of the Lord's work in terms of charity. I get nothing out of the story about Scientology except a kind of bleakness and blackness. It's very much like the cover of your book. You know, it just feels like this is a perversion of religion. This is about making money. This is not about what the tradition and understanding is, that why people are religious in the first place and what religion gives to people.
Well, the question of religion is really complicated. You know, what does that term encompass? There are so many different ways of expressing spiritual thoughts. And, you know, what is a cult? What is a religion? What is just simply a business enterprise, which is what the IRS thought that the Church of Scientology was up until 1993. And the IRS is the only agency entitled to make such distinctions, as poorly equipped as it is. Can you imagine a bunch of accountants and lawyers having to decide what's a religion? And, you know, the truth is we wouldn't be talking about Scientology now if the church had not gotten that tax exemption, L. Ron Hubbard, the founder, had decided not to pay his taxes. And by 1993, after his death, and the church owed $1 billion in back taxes, and it didn't have $1 billion, and it was going to go out of business if it did not get an exemption. And so the way that the new leader of the church, David Miscavige, went about gaining that exemption was to launch 2,300 lawsuits against the IRS and individual agents, and hire private investigators to follow agents around, and write smear stories in Scientology magazines. I don't know exactly what the merits of the case were when, behind closed doors, this exemption was negotiated with the Church of Scientology, but we do know that that $1 billion was forgiven. There was a $12 million fine, and the lawsuits were dropped and the private investigators were called off.
And also, wasn't at that moment, wasn't the meeting that took place with the IRS commissioner off the books, impromptu? Didn't Miscavige just show up for a private meeting and a deal was struck?
What happened, that for years, the Church of Scientology has an extraordinary retinue of lawyers. And the lawyers had been dealing with, some of them had been dealing with the IRS. And there was a lunch at the Bombay Club in Washington, D.C., where Miscavige and his chief lieutenant, Marty Rathbun, were meeting with Gerald Pfeffer, who was the main attorney in D.C. working for them, and some other lawyers. And Miscavige just said, I've had it. Let's go over to the IRS and meet with Fred Goldberg, who was the IRS commissioner at the time. And the attorney just sort of laughed at him. But Miscavige and Rathbun went over to 1111 Constitution Avenue and walked into the IRS and said, we'd like to see the commissioner. Well, do you have an appointment? No, but if you tell him we're from the Church of Scientology, I think he'd be interested. And sure enough, delegates came downstairs right away, and they arranged a meeting the following week. And at that point, this process took more than a year, but the IRS was essentially negotiating with the Church of Scientology over the terms of its surrender, because the IRS did give the church its tax exemption.
So Lawrence Wright, again, the author of the new book, Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. What do people get out of it? I mean, in your New Yorker profile of the movie director and writer here in Hollywood, Paul Haggis, who quit the church ostensibly because his daughter was gay and that he was outraged at their hypocrisy about supporting Prop 8 here in California, which is in the process of being overturned. But there has to be some reason why a successful Hollywood screenwriter and movie maker was giving millions of dollars to this organization. There has to be a reason why the woman who does the voice of Bart Simpson gave them $10 million. Again, getting back to my earlier question about what is this in terms of a church, in terms of a spiritual organization, in as much as it's very hard to understand what it gives back to the community and its own members, rather than what appears to be the case, that they, run a kind of slave ship. So I'm curious to understand, or maybe it's just because the elite members get these benefits, but what are the actual benefits? Why do you need to spend millions and millions of dollars to get to what?
Well, take the example of Paul Haggis that you mentioned. When Paul was a young man in London, Ontario, Canada, he was walking down the street and someone sold him a copy of Dianetics, which was L. Ron Hubbard's big best-selling self-therapy book in 1950. And it said inside, Church of Scientology. And so Paul was curious and went to the church. It was just a couple of guys. There were hardly any Scientologists in the whole province at that time. But if you were to walk into your Church of Scientology, they would ask you, what is ruining your life? What's standing in the way of your financial or professional or emotional or spiritual success? And everybody has something. And in Paul's case, he had a difficult relationship with his girlfriend. And the Scientologist said, well, we can help you with that. We have classes. You can take courses that will help you in your relationship. And Paul felt that those courses did help him. He and his girlfriend then moved to L.A. and got married. They became more deeply involved in the church because it formed a part of the community that they were in. He started associating with other people in the entertainment business. He wanted to be a writer. So there was a Scientologist writing group formed up that operated out of the Celebrity Center in Hollywood. And he began to get some writing jobs through that. His sister joined the Sea Org, which was this Scientology clergy. His children began going to Scientology schools, and he was climbing all the time the ladder of Scientology's spiritual progress. At the time, it wasn't so expensive, but he went all the way to the top, hoping, as so many people do, to gain the kind of access to enlightenment that the church promised. And it was never really clear what was over the horizon. It was just something that was going to be great. And, you know, you would be a better and more powerful being. And you would learn how to, control the material universe. You'd be invulnerable to diseases. Your intelligence would be higher. Your eyesight would be better. I mean, there are, you know, many things that were all pledged to be a part of this. And, of course, people did get sick. Their eyes didn't improve. Their relationships fell apart. All these things happened, but it was always determined that it was your fault for not following the dictates of Scientology strictly. And after all, people had invested a lot of money in it. It was now their, in Paul's case and so many other cases, it was their community. Their family was involved in it. There were a lot of reasons not to leave. Once you begin, you go into the church and you are illusioned with the idea that these things will all come to you. And when they don't come to you, you may go through a process of disillusion. But the process of actually leaving is a bigger step because you leave so much behind. And it's embarrassing to think that you spent all that money, to think that you might have given credence to stuff that other people would determine was absolutely ridiculous. Those things are very hard obstacles to overcome.
Sure. Well, isn't it also true that the church itself gets very aggressive towards people who are either thinking of defecting or certainly who have defected? You mentioned Marty Rathman, who obviously was at the highest levels. Yeah. He's a prominent defector, is he not?
Yes, indeed he is. And it's different for people like that because Marty was a member of the Sea Org, which is their clergy. And, oftentimes people go into that organization at alarmingly young ages as children. They sign a contract for 1 billion years of service with the idea that, you live lifetime after lifetime and you're paid a nominal, $50 a week. You surrender your education and, you're placed into, working 60, 80-hour weeks. You have very little contact with the outside world. And if there's a point when you're now a grown person and you're thinking, maybe I've wasted my life, maybe I should get out of here, you're faced with even more greater difficulties. One is you're broke.
You're not educated. I have a friend, by the way, Lawrence, who a theater director who was doing a play reading and had a young actress at the play reading who had gone to Scientology school, and this actress could not read a script.
Yeah.
I mean, it's shocking.
Yeah, the educational techniques that Scientology employs are very disputed. And it was the case of Paul Haggis's, one of his daughters, who couldn't write her own name when she was 11 years old. So it's difficult for people like that to get away. And in the case of Marty Rathbun and a lot of other members of the executive tier who are a part of the Sea Org, they literally had to escape. They fled. And it's often the case that they're brought back, occasionally physically. Many people have told me about being beaten by the leader of the church.
David Miscavige.
Many people say they've been involuntarily confined in re-education camps that the church maintains in various locations, sometimes for years on end.
And does that ever have echoes of North Korea or something like that? I mean, that's something, again, it's so hard to understand how you could associate that kind of totalitarian treatment to a religion.
It's an interesting. I talked to Robert J. Lifton, who did a lot of the work on Chinese communism right after the Korean War, and a very influential figure in this thinking. He doesn't use the term brainwashing. He talks about mind control and thought reform, but he speaks of the totalistic universe. That when you're placed in an environment where all the answers to your possible questions are already there, and you know it's a self-reinforcing environment where you're expected to adhere to the dictates of the group and give it everything. Just an example, the one that I found very impressive of how that mindset takes root. There's a desert compound in Southern California called the Gold Base, which is the international headquarters of the Sea Organization. And on that base, they have a re-education camp they call the Hole. It's actually two double-wide trailers that have been married together that used to be an office suite until 2006 when Miscavige had the furniture cleared out and began to confine his executives there, up more than 100 at one point. And they slept on the floor. They were only allowed out once a day to shower. And they ate table scraps out of buckets. And they spent a lot of time criticizing each other and trying to confess their sins. There was a considerable amount of physical abuse. In one deposition or court deposition was a story of one of the people who was made to mop the floor of the toilet with his tongue. Now, and the president of the church, the nominal post, Heber Jensch, an elderly man, was in there for 7 years. Now, one night, David Miscavige, according to many of my sources, came into the Hole carrying a jam box. And he said, "We're going to play a game, musical chairs." And he had chairs brought in, arranged in a circle. And he said, "The last person sitting in the chair will get to stay. Everybody else, we're going to, you know, put you out, throw you out of the Sea Org or send you off to some distant post. Husbands and wives are going to be separated." And airline tickets were actually printed up to give reality to this scene. And so he was playing Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. And whenever the music stopped, you know, the people would fight for the chairs. As the number of chairs diminished, clothes were torn, punches were thrown, chairs were broken. And what's so striking to me about this, they were fighting to stay there in the Hole. That, to me, was the most vivid example of the mindset, the totalistic mindset that had taken root inside the minds of those people.
Well, it's a sort of Stockholm Syndrome type of situation, it seems. What explains this kind of sadism on the part of Miscavige? And obviously, yet when you talk about these people working as galley slaves, rowing the centurion at the on the bridge, who's living the life of a billionaire, his best friend, I believe, is Tom Cruise, and it's difficult not to wonder whether the Tom Cruises and the John Travoltas are not what the KGB used to refer to Western dupes of theirs as useful idiots, in the sense that they are out there advertising that Scientology is the reason for their success. At the same time, the person who's in charge of this religion is living such an opulent life at the expense of those. And not only that, what you just told us is sadism and depravity, and it has no place in civilized behavior. I just don't understand how this could be called a religion.
Let me speak directly about the role of the celebrities in Scientology, since you just touched on this, and their responsibility. Scientology was set up in Los Angeles in 1954. The church was established here, and the Celebrity Center was built in Hollywood. The church now owns $400 million worth of property in Hollywood. It's one of the big landowners. And early on in the church's history, they published a roster of prospective Scientologists who would, you know, represent the church to the world. And they included names like Bob Hope and Marlene Dietrich and Howard Hughes and, just the most famous people in the world. But they wanted that kind of figure to be the face of Scientology. And the first of those that they actually succeeded in getting was John Travolta, who was not famous when he joined the church, but he became famous. And he always said that Scientology put him into the big time. He was the most popular movie star in the world after Saturday Night Fever. It was a very powerful thing to have somebody like that representing the church. And then shortly thereafter, Tom Cruise, through his first wife, Mimi Rogers, is introduced to the Church of Scientology. And he is also, you know, this is early in his career when he has become the signal, maybe one of the most famous movie actors in all of history, you know, just an incredibly popular actor. So Travolta and Cruise, between the two of them, and there are other, you know, other cast of characters that we all know their names, but those two figures defined Scientology in the popular mind, and they sold it to people because of their affiliation, because their repeated defense of the church whenever it was under attack, and their credit that they gave to the church for making them the kinds of people, the kinds of movie stars that they are today. Well, I think they bear an enormous moral responsibility for looking at the product that they're actually retailing. I'm not criticizing them as human beings or actors. I am saying that for years and years, they have been used by the church, exploited by the church, in order to spread the word. And they have done so. I think they have a responsibility to all those people that have been drawn to the church because of their example, to see what is actually going on inside the upper tier of Scientology. Because if any reform is ever going to take place inside the church, it's those people that are going to have to stand up and say, we have to change.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we will return with Lawrence Wright, who is here in the studio with me, and discuss his new book, Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief.
It's time to get away. It's time to get away from you. It's time to get away. It's time to get away from you. You brought a lot of money.
The aliens were no longer frozen. They were dead. The souls of those aliens, however, lived on and all floated up towards the sky. But the evil Lord Xenu had prepared for this. Xenu didn't want their souls to return, and so he built giant soul catchers in the sky. The souls were taken to a huge soul brainwashing facility, which Xenu had also built on Earth. There the souls were forced to watch days of brainwashing material, which tricked them into believing...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and... Here in the studio with me, resuming the conversation, is Lawrence Wright, the staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of the new book, Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. So we talked earlier about how, because of their proactive and litigious nature of Scientology against its critics, how in a curious way they have led to this, your book, the new book, Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief, being so bulletproof in the sense that you had to do so much fact-checking and legal checking. And it looks as though, I don't know whether there's a cause and effect here, but I've noticed that Scientology is now taken to the airwaves making commercials, which are sort of amorphous in a way, not quite sure what they're selling or what they're saying. Although the latest one that I noticed was a homage to L. Ron Hubbard, that more or less, you know, obviously he walks on water.
Yes.
In this case, he walks on water throughout the universe.
Well, they have a lot of money. And but I think that the Scientology message is very muddled right now. It's the most stigmatized religion in the country, and it's earned its reputation. I think it's at a crossroads right now because it's certainly heading for a reckoning. You cannot have this kind of behavior that has been alleged going on inside the church at the very top without having an accounting at some point. Church has a lot of money and has a lot of lawyers, so it's well defended. But I think it's hemorrhaging members like crazy, and it cannot exist, and it will not appeal to new generation of Scientologists unless it's able to get its house in order. And that's why I particularly point to the celebrity members, because they have the capacity, perhaps, to bring about some kind of change inside their church.
Well, this is a church, though, that appears to, in the case of these celebrity members, and particularly with going back to John Travolta, it seems that what their MO is that they get these young, vulnerable Hollywood types who have early success and then obviously participate in sex, drugs, and rock and roll, which is a sort of a ritual here in Los Angeles. And it's almost as though they take them off those drugs and put them on their drugs. And the part of it that I find extraordinary is the extent to which they build dossiers on people based upon these sort of primitive lie detector tests, the e-meter things, where you're encouraged to unburden yourself. All of those records are kept. And my understanding is that when people defect or try to defect, they, like to get a phone call at 3 a.m. with a tape playing, the most intimate details of from their childhood or something. This seems to be, and there are lots of very credible and serious psychiatrists in academia. Their careers have been ruined and they've been harassed by Scientology. So what is this jihad they have against psychiatry and psychopharmacology? Is it simply that they want you on their drug, not on other drugs? And what's going on here? Why this venom?
That's an interesting parallel that you draw. And I think it's accurate in the sense that, if you trace back when L. Ron Hubbard turned against psychiatry, his first book, Dianetics, was essentially a, therapeutic self-help manual. And he wrote it in a month. He had this blazing fast ability to write a 400-page book in a month. But, he sent the manuscript off to the American Psychiatric and American Psychological Associations with the idea that they were going to put their stamp of approval on it and say, hallelujah, a new leader has arisen. And they looked at this book and laughed at it because it was full of studies that, never existed. And they thought of it as psychological folk art, and they just didn't know what to make of it. That really wounded Hubbard, even though his book became this international bestseller and dominated the New York Times bestseller list and really set the category of the self-help book that became so popular after World War II. But it was in the same vein as psychology, psychiatry, therapy. It was in that camp. I think the insult that he felt from the organizations manifested itself in his undying hostility to psychiatry. And he holds the profession responsible for all the ills that plague mankind, for racism, for terrorism, for war. It all goes back.
The Holocaust.
The Holocaust, yeah. Everything goes back to psychiatry. And it's a difficult case to make. But sometimes they stretch the truth a little bit to try to, for instance, there's a museum of psychiatry that Scientology maintains here in Los Angeles. And I went over there one day to see what they had on the exhibit. And, one of their exhibits, for instance, is about Al-Qaeda. And it happens to be a subject I know a lot about. And,
right, the Looming Tower. Right. Yeah.
They said that Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's now the leader of al-Qaeda but was then the number two, was a psychiatrist and that he had taken control of bin Laden's mind. Well, he's a surgeon. He's not a... And then they said another person that was involved in the Madrid bombings was a psychiatrist, and he had nothing to do with the Madrid bombings, and in fact, he was a car salesman. But, you know, these assertions often go unchallenged, but it's all a part of the brief that Scientology makes against psychiatry. And you saw it manifested in, you know, that famous exchange that Tom Cruise had with Matt Lauer about Brooke Shields. You know, you don't know the history of psychiatry, Matt. I do, is what he said. And this, the history that he's referring to is the one that Hubbard and the Church of Scientology have manufactured.
So Lawrence Wright, again, the author of the new book, Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. You mentioned how the organization is hemorrhaging members. Many, it seems, at the top level. There's some very high-level defections. I believe Miscavige's own niece.
Jenna Miscavige.
Yeah, I've seen her sort of briefly on television, painting an extremely shocking picture of the inner workings of the king that lives this extraordinary, lavish life, and whose best friend apparently is, and closest companion is Tom Cruise. And then what about his Miscavige's wife, Shelley? Where is she gone, or she's missing, or
she's missing? She disappeared in 2006. She appeared once for her father's funeral that took place shortly after that. But since then, she's not been seen. Former Scientology executives think that she's being held in the Scientology, remote Scientology camp.
Not the one that you get to the gold base.
No. This is a very remote place where all of L. Ron Hubbard's works are held in titanium canisters inside a nuclear blast resistant cavern.
Is that the one in New Mexico?
Well, there are several.
Right.
Then there's one in Southern California as well.
Right. Because I believe the one in New Mexico has a symbol that's pointing up at space.
Yeah, there are interlocking circles that look a little bit like Olympic circles, but the idea is that a passing spaceship would recognize it, or the reincarnated spirit of Hubbard if he were looking for some place to land.
So that leads you to this bizarre theology of this religion, and it's sort of curious in a way that they consider this trademark material. In other words, the more you try to talk about the tenets of the church, I mean, you can go to pick up a Catholic catechism, you can pick up, Reverend Hagee will be happy to sell you a Bible, you know. We know what the texts are, what the beliefs are. It's all published. That's the whole point.
Right.
Their stuff is held so secret. So the more you learn about it, the more bizarre it is. But at the same time, they turn around and ridicule what you're saying it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, when you try and find out exactly what is true, then they lawyer up and say, no, that's copyrighted material.
All that material, you know, all the pertinent material that you're talking about, it's called the OT levels, Operating Thetan. And most of that stuff was dumped out in the courtroom in the middle of the 80s, and that's how it got to be public knowledge. And the church never really recovered from that. For one thing, people paid dearly to gain access to that kind of information. And, you know, to get to the top of the OT8, the OT8 is the highest level now in Scientology, it would cost you maybe $500,000. And that's aside from all the auditing and the building fund pledges and so on that you are required or asked to make. So it's a very, very expensive process. And then suddenly it was available on the internet and ridiculed on South Park, and it was no longer a secret. That's been very, very difficult for the church to recover from, because they were selling esoteric knowledge. And once it lost that status and was freely examined and critically examined in public venues, it's been a shattering blow for the church. People still do it.
Sure.
But I think that was a turning point in the history of the church.
But the premise seems to be that we're all thetans who've fallen from grace, and you know, without getting into the Lord Xanu and the volcanoes with the atomic weapons and whatever, it strikes me as a form of kind of a spiritual enema that you just have to purge yourself of everything, of all these blockages, mm-hmm. that eventually you reach a point where you can totally purged and therefore you're clear. And I mean, obviously that's a rather rudimentary explanation, yeah. but that's my best understanding of it. Is that in any way accurate?
In Scientology, it's believed that you're infested with what are called body thetans, which are these disembodied spirits that are looking for home. And so they cling to you. And along with them, they bring your neuroses and fears, the kinds of things that cause you to behave irrationally and unsuccessfully. And they may give you illness. You know, all these things are part of the body thetans that are inside you. And when you get to a certain level past OT3, you spend a lot of time alone with your e-meter, sort of surveying your sense of well-being, trying to examine, you know, is there something, do I feel a pressure? Do I feel a pain? Do I feel a fear? You monitor, and then you try to discern this, you know, alien spirit that is inside you. It's in some respects akin to the notion in Christianity of casting out demons, because, you know, it's a psychological idea that there's something inside you. It's not you that's causing this behavior. It's the demon or the alien being or the body thetan that's inside you.
Well, I was about to make some reference to the Catholic Church casting out demons at the tune of billions of dollars. Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Lawrence Wright.
It's always a pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Wright, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of God's Favorite, In the New World, Saints and Sinners, Remembering Satan, and The Looming Tower, which was recipient of the Pulitzer Prize, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and the New York Public Library Helen Brownstein Book Award for Excellence in Journalism. He's also a screenwriter and playwright, and his latest book just out is Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.